Hello, and welcome to the College of Nursing segment on the Positive Health Podcast. My name is Andrew Snyder, and I am a co-host of the Positive Health Podcast. This podcast is an initiative designed to create a platform for students in the interdisciplinary health sectors to explore a range of health issues through a positive lens. The Positive Health Podcast also helps to provide awareness and literacy on current and emerging issues for undergraduate and graduate students at Kent State University. Today, I'm joined by Katie Harkula, senior nursing and honors student, and our special guest, Dr. Tara Smith, professor of epidemiology and infectious disease expert, to discuss the topic of vaccine hesitancy. Welcome, Katie and Dr. Smith.
Thanks for having me.
Hi, thanks for having me as well.
Katie, I know you've invested a great deal of time this semester looking into vaccines throughout history. Would you like to start by sharing with us some of your findings?
Sure. So the COVID vaccine has been pretty highly anticipated since the beginning of the pandemic, and it's finally here. But the first vaccine was actually created by Edward Jenner in 1796, and it was used to prevent the spread of smallpox. He actually used cowpox to inoculate people against this. The Anti-Vaccination Society of America, however, was founded in 1879, and this was influenced by anti-vaccination movements in England, and it was out of anger towards recent vaccination laws that required them. Dr. Smith, I was wondering, are there any anti-vaccination societies like this around today?
Yes, unfortunately. The anti-vaccine movement has kind of waxed and waned over the years. So the one you're discussing was, again, kind of activated in response to mandatory smallpox vaccination, which was necessary to control that in the population. And so we've seen those pop up again, especially when some vaccines do go from being voluntary to being mandatory in certain populations. We've had probably the oldest notable anti-vaccine organization in the U.S. that's still active right now is a group called the National Vaccine Information Center. It sounds very sciencey, but if you go to their website, you see it's actually full of kind of anti-vaccine tropes and vaccine misinformation. That is run by a woman named Barbara Lowe Fisher, who claims that she believes that her child was harmed by a vaccine back in the 1980s, and was really one of the leaders in this movement in the 80s and 90s. Again, at that time, the ire around vaccines was mostly targeted at the DTP vaccines, so diphtheria, tetanus, and pertussis, that they thought resulted in harm to some children who got it. So that, again, kind of took off in the 80s, waned a little bit in the 90s, and then at the end of the 90s was Andrew Wakefield's paper that was published looking at the MMR vaccine, the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine, as a cause of autism. It was, of course, later retracted, and it was found out that Wakefield had all sorts of undisclosed conflicts of interest, which eventually led to the loss of his medical license in England and his move to the United States. But since then, that has led to kind of a resurgence in the anti-vaccine movement in the U.S., and so we have other groups, including Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s group, Children's Health Defense, which also sounds noble, but again is really devoted to anti-vaccine misinformation. Del Bigtree is a newer one on the scene. He runs a show called The High Wire that has gotten a lot of attention, especially over the pandemic. And then there are a lot of state and local groups. So in Ohio, we have two active anti-vaccine groups. One is called Health Freedom Ohio, and the other, Ohio Advocates for Medical Freedom. So they're really focused on the idea of medical freedom. Anti-vaccination as a term has kind of been discarded by most who are actually anti-vaccination now, because they know that really that's poison, that so much of the population really do believe in vaccines that to say one is anti-vaccine is kind of a non-starter. So they've focused a different terminology. But if you look at the arguments, you see a lot of the same things that are recycled just in modern terminology that are the same as they were at the end of the 1800s.
All right, so it sounds like people should just sort of be kind of weary of some of the names of these groups because they could sound very scientific then.
Absolutely. I mean, they know how to do propaganda and they know how to do it well. So they're not going to appeal to people by saying they're anti-vaccine. They're trying to promote a positive spin on that, again, you know, suggesting that they're for medical choice or for medical freedom. Of course, that only means for the choice of those who choose not to get vaccinated, rather than the choice of the rest of the population who doesn't want to be exposed to vaccine-preventable diseases.
Thank you for all of that information. In 1952, there was the polio epidemic, where many children fell ill, some were left paralyzed, and some even died. And schools closed similar to what's happening today. Notably, schools in Chicago started using radios and newspapers to reach their students, which is a little bit different than today's virtual learning, but still the same concept. They were waiting for the Salk vaccine, which came in 1955. So I was just wondering, how does the technology used in 1955 compare to the technology that was used today?
In some ways, it's unchanged, and in other ways, it's quite different. So in the 1950s, was really prior to the dawn of molecular biology. You know, at that time, we were just even beginning to understand the structure of DNA. And of course, we didn't have any way to replicate that at the time. And now we can do that in a few minutes. So what Salk and the other developer of the polio vaccine, the oral polio vaccine, Sabin, were working to do was to take the polio virus and adapt it in such ways that a safe vaccine could be used. And so Salk did this by inactivating the virus. So basically just treating the virus. They tried different ways with chemicals and with heat to give an individual the whole virus, but one that would not replicate in the body. Whereas Sabin's polio vaccine was a live vaccine, but it had been passaged in certain ways so that it would no longer be virulent, so that it wouldn't cause the infection in people, but would still cause them to develop immunity. And so these are kind of crude techniques compared to what we have today. So today, for example, with the mRNA vaccines that we have, as soon as we had the viral sequence, people working at Pfizer and Moderna and other companies could take the mRNA sequence of the virus spike proteins, which are the antigens, the proteins that our immune system recognizes, and use those to create the mRNA vaccines right away. So by the time they had the viral sequence, you know, it took days for them to develop the first vaccines. And of course, they did have to be tested in the same ways that Salk and Sabin were back in the day in these large clinical trials, looking first at safety of these vaccines and then looking at how they actually worked, what we call vaccine efficacy. So the trial procedures have not changed as much. And indeed, the polio vaccines were really the first ones that we had these very large clinical trials to test them. But, you know, the speed with which we can develop these and the accuracy, you know, using these mRNA particles rather than having to take a whole vaccine or whole virus, excuse me, and just inactivate that or try to attenuate it in ways that could lead to uncertain outcomes. You know, that's really a huge advantage today and has allowed us to do this so quickly.
So the speed of vaccine development then has nothing to do with the safety of it. It's just that technology today allows us to develop them faster.
Right, exactly. And they were able to, you know, test them so quickly because we have, you know, unfortunately, so much live virus circulating. So you have a lot of people that are exposed to that. So you can very quickly, you know, recruit in their case, you know, almost 100,000 people combined into the trials, and then test that efficacy because you have a lot of people who are out there getting sick. So it's the only silver lining maybe for the pandemic was that it allowed these vaccines to be tested so quickly.
That is unfortunate that that's our reason why that we can test vaccines faster, but glad that we are able to do that now. So with the polio vaccine, there wasn't really any government regulation in development or distribution, and that actually caused some children to end up ill after receiving the vaccine. And I know a lot of people today are hesitant to receive the COVID vaccine due to the government's involvement in its development and distribution, just because they feel that scientists should be doing the work or they fear of what is actually being put in the vaccine. So what are some of the reasons that the public should know about as to why it is necessary for the government to be involved in vaccine development and distribution?
Yeah, I think in this case, it was really important that the government did step in here. So a big one is funding. So with any of these vaccines, you just never know when you start out which ones are going to work the best. I was honestly quite skeptical of the mRNA vaccines that I didn't have a lot of concerns about safety, but I did have concerns about their efficacy, whether they would work or not. So, you know, when we had some of these being funded by the government to start off with and do their studies, you know, we had to put funding in a lot of different pots because we just didn't know which one would work the best. And it surprised me, honestly, that both Moderna and Pfizer's mRNA vaccines were both so successful. So I'm really glad that they were able to secure funding either for the development of those vaccines in the case of Moderna or, you know, kind of a guaranteed contract to distribute them afterwards and have the government purchase them in the case of Pfizer. It's really risky for companies to bet on vaccines because, again, you have such a high possibility of failure. So I think in this case, it was so important that the government supported those to allow those companies to take these risks and to get these vaccines out, because we have seen some of them fail in other vaccine trials. Lots of vaccines never make it to the market because they just don't work well enough. So having this government partnership with the pharmaceutical companies really helped speed up the process and give the companies confidence that they could go forward with their trials. We also want to see, you know, the partnership between distribution. And that's one thing that unfortunately was lacking a little bit in late 2020, and we're just starting to catch up now in 2021. Was that the federal government did not have a lot of plans as far as vaccine distribution. That's one thing that could have been much stronger from the Trump administration, was to have those plans in place to get the vaccine actually into arms rather than just sitting in distribution centers. So, you know, that's one reason we really need this federal coordination, is so that we can distribute the vaccine in ways that are equitable and fair. So, you know, from my point of view, I don't think there's a contradiction between government and scientists, because it's a lot of scientists who work in the government at, you know, the FDA, who works to approve these vaccines, and the CDC, who works to provide recommendations for who should be using these vaccines. And then, of course, local and state public health departments, which have made the final recommendations as far as priority groups and things like that, based mostly on CDC recommendations. So it's not some kind of either or, it's both and. You know, we have individuals from the government working hand in hand with scientists who develop the vaccines and other scientists who develop policy to try to work out the best ways to get these vaccines distributed, and then also to do that monitoring. You know, both before the vaccines are approved, they go through three phases of trials, but then even after the vaccines have been, in this case, authorized through an emergency use authorization and are being given to now millions of people, we're still looking at safety and effectiveness issues. So it's not like research stops once the vaccine gets out into people. There could be very rare outcomes that happen once distributions, you know, takes off, and could be long-term effects. So we still look at vaccine safety even after they're distributed. So people should just know that all of this is going on. And that, of course, it's a lot of scientists as well who are taking these vaccines. And so if we feel confident enough to take them, we feel confident in the technology, then I would hope that other people would as well.
That all makes so much sense as to how the government and scientists are working together and why that's all necessary for us. So H1N1, or also known as the swine flu, was declared a pandemic in 2009, which is the last pandemic I remember in my lifetime. This resulted in an upper respiratory illness, and most of the cases with this were in children aged 12 to 17. However, it was also particularly dangerous to pregnant women. Some of these people required hospitalization, and most deaths occurred in middle-aged adults. So due to this, when the H1N1 vaccine came out, healthcare workers were obviously a priority, but so were pregnant women and young children. And then people with things like cardiovascular disease, respiratory conditions, autoimmune disorders, and diabetes. But with the COVID vaccine, healthcare workers are still prioritized since they're most likely to be coming in contact with it more often. But since this virus more so affects the elderly population and is more dangerous to them, they're the ones being prioritized for the vaccinations. So why should populations who were not initially prioritized for H1N1, but who are prioritized for the COVID vaccine, why should they feel safe receiving it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's always a risk-benefit analysis. So the reason we prioritize some different groups in those two pandemics is because, as you noted, people have different risk factors. The flu is not the same as coronavirus, and it affects different populations differently. So in this case, we've seen that, you know, the most affected group are the elderly, followed by other individuals who have various pre-existing conditions that can make them, if they contract the virus, they can get a more serious infection. So that's always what we try to look at when we prioritize vaccines in a pandemic type situation or any situation where vaccines will be more limited than a rollout in the general population. And so I would hope that those individuals, you know, understand that we are trying to protect them. We are trying to get to the groups that are either most exposed, like healthcare workers, or those that are most vulnerable to serious COVID infection, like the elderly and some of the other groups. So we do this again, you know, every time something like this happens. This is a new vaccine. We don't yet have enough for the entire population. So we have to pick and choose who gets it first. And that has led to these priority groups. But eventually it will be like the H1N1 vaccine. So now that is part of our yearly influenza vaccine. We get an H, you know, usually there are three or four strains of influenza that are included, including two for influenza A and two for influenza B. And since 2009, there has been some strain of H1N1 that's included in the yearly influenza vaccine. And so this will happen with coronavirus as well once we get enough vaccine out there that, you know, we anticipate this may be something that we need to take every, you know, maybe every few years as the virus changes. And once there's enough vaccine, you know, everyone will be able to get it, including right now, you know, there's no vaccine for children under the age of 16.
Right.
So at some point, you know, once we finish those tests and get that done, you know, this will be available for children. This will be available for anyone who wants it. But now that it's just we don't have the supply of vaccine necessary. So that will happen eventually, just like it did with H1N1 in 2009.
Do you think that there's any possibility if COVID does become a yearly vaccine that it could be rolled into the flu vaccine so only one injection is needed?
Yeah, they're definitely looking at that. And, you know, right now it's probably not possible because there's such different kinds of vaccines. You know, the typical flu vaccine is much more like the Salk polio vaccine. It's an inactivated virus. So you have to grow up the virus in cell culture or in eggs. You take the virus, you inactivate it with usually chemicals like formaldehyde, clean it up, and that's your vaccine. So very different from the mRNA vaccine that we're using for COVID. So different storage needs, you know, different ways to administer it, as far as how you have to make up the new mRNA vaccine and use it in certain times. That's not the same thing as flu. So right now that would not be possible, but maybe down the line, I know certainly one of the things they are looking at is using an mRNA platform for new influenza vaccines, just because it takes away all of those cell culture issues and it could be made probably more quickly than our current vaccine is. So perhaps, you know, in 5 or 10 years, maybe they would have an mRNA flu vaccine that could be given at the same time as the mRNA COVID vaccine.
Well, hopefully for those people who fear needles, that will come sooner than later.
Yes.
So as college students and young adults, we're still sort of new at making our own important health decisions, since growing up, it was mostly our parents that made them for us, or I know vaccines are mandated in order to attend school. So what message do you have for college students who might be hesitant to make that decision for themselves to receive the COVID vaccine once it's available to them?
Yeah, I would, you know, if their parents are still trusted sources of medical information, I would still chat with them. I know not everyone has that luxury. Some parents just aren't. But if you do have a good relationship with your parents and they are good sources of information, chat with them. We have people here in student health, you know, that are happy to discuss these things with you. I know they're a little overwhelmed at this time, but, you know, they have good information on the website. We're developing developing our own KSU website that will have all kinds of information on the coronavirus vaccine. So lots of frequently asked questions. So if you're just looking for kind of the basic information, that's will be a good place to start very soon here. Talk to your friends, talk to those, especially those in the medical areas or public health areas that may have knowledge of this. Lots of them are really working hard right now as advocates for vaccination and other public health interventions. So, look for people you trust. In some cases, it could be even, members of your church or things like that. There's lots of people out there who could give you good information on this, but it really comes down to that trust relationship that you have to understand people who have good information, where they're getting that from, and why they should be a trusted source on health issues.
Right. So I know the news and social media play a large role in where people get their information. So besides those trustworthy people in our lives and our peers and the KSU website, is there any other reliable sources you would recommend that people check out for their own research about the vaccine?
Yeah, I mean, the CDC is always a good place to start. One of the problems with CDC, though, is it is a little bit dense sometimes. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it can also be hard to find the specific information you're looking for, because they will often have lots of pages devoted to, to COVID or something like that. So you can try to start there. Ohio Department of Health also has a website, again, devoted to COVID and other pages devoted to other infectious diseases and things like that. But obviously, COVID has gotten the lion's share of attention recently. For vaccine information in general, CHOP, Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, is a really good resource. It has information on a lot of the basic vaccines, kind of how they're made, information about the infectious disease they protect against, side effects they may have, things like that. So they've, worked for years to make a good readable website about that information. So I would, recommend those as first passes. But one thing especially for college students to think about also is to develop a relationship with some kind of primary healthcare practitioner. And I know that's tough as college students.
Right.
But if you can find someone to work with, to keep track of your health, at least for those, 4 or so years that you're in school, that's really helpful because, your health changes over time and having some kind of baseline health record, is really helpful. And then that also is a person you start to know and maybe you can develop a trusting relationship with and you can go to with questions that maybe aren't answered in the regular, FAQs on a website or something like that are more personalized to you.
Well, thank you very much for sharing all of your information and your knowledge on this topic with me. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Happy to help. So for people who are looking for more information, I do teach a fall class every year, and I'm still not sure if it will be completely remote or asynchronous or, potentially partly in class. I don't know. But my fall class is called Plagues and Pandemics, and so that is available to undergraduates, and it also can be slashed as a master's class. So if you're interested in more of the history of pandemics and infectious diseases, and of course, this will now have a COVID section, that will be available in the fall.
This has been great. I'd like to thank both Katie and Dr. Smith for dissecting this important topic for all of us. We hope you'll continue to listen and engage with the Positive Health Podcast episodes, not only generated by nursing students at Kent State University, but also by students from other health and wellness fields across campus. If you have any questions about this topic, or would like to submit a topic for a future segment, you can email positivehealthpodcast@gmail.com. A link to this email can be found in the description of this segment at anchor.fm/public health. Thank you for listening.